Welcome to the Agile Wire, where professional Scrum trainers Jeff Bubbles and Jeff Molesky discuss Agile topics. Now, here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Jeff Molesky.
And we are recording. All right, Mr. Bubbles, kick us off, man.
All right, so this week we got Roman Pitchler on the podcast with us. Roman is the author of books, four different books on Scrum and product management and product ownership. And I don't know, he's one of the experts that I look to from a product ownership standpoint. And so happy to have you on, Roman. Thanks for joining us.
It's nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So let's dive right into roadmaps. I guess I think of you as one of the experts on roadmaps and product roadmaps. And how do you suggest people use them? There's many different types of roadmaps out there. When do you use which ones and why?
Yeah, great question. So product roadmaps, I find, are or can be important and helpful tools for product people, Scrum product owners. But I think the way they're often applied is not necessarily very effective. Traditionally, product roadmaps are very much focused on features. That's at least, you know, my experience. So we're saying we want certain features delivered, certain pieces of functionality, and then often, you know, there's a specific date when those features or pieces of functionality should be available. And per se, that's nothing bad. But when you put it in an agile context, then there's the danger of an overlap with the product backlog, so that the product roadmap starts competing with the product backlog. And that's kind of not nice. And it makes the product roadmap then fairly volatile, which means it needs to be updated and changed fairly regularly. And you know, any plan like the product roadmap should be regularly reviewed anyway. But if it changes every other week, then you know, I think that cadence, that frequency, that volatility is just a little bit too high. I think for product roadmap, as it's more a higher level strategic plan, more like a midterm plan, I think, you know, it's nice to have a little bit more stability. And then maybe more importantly, with all those features, sometimes the reason why we want to spend time, money, and energy on our product and progress our product is a little bit lost. And we're sort of then really are super busy just pushing out those features and pieces of functionality without truly understanding what is the value that we want to create. And so that's why, you know, I'm quite a big fan of goal-oriented roadmaps, or some people prefer the term outcome-based or benefit-based or benefits-based roadmaps, where we first and foremost really try and describe the specific value, the specific outcomes, the specific benefits that we want to create with our product. And in a way, use that to you know, tell a little story, create a narrative, and sort of describe at least, you know, roughly what's the journey we'd like to take our product on over, say, the next 6 to 12 months. And then, you know, features can still be useful in terms of the output and the deliverables in order to understand roughly what might it take to achieve a specific outcome. But for me, they should always be dependent on a specific product goal, on the roadmap, or a specific outcome. And so, you know, if a stakeholder comes to you and says, oh, you know, you must implement this feature, then the question will be, oh, you know, is there a goal on the product roadmap that, you know, this feature would support? And if not, well, would it be worthwhile to change a goal or introduce a new goal? And, you know, if the answer is no to those questions, then, you know, maybe that feature is not that relevant at this point in time.
Right. Or maybe it's a future goal that we want to achieve. And so that's where we'll put that in the back burner until then. Right. So, yeah, I like that. You know, one of the things that I like to do is combine like your goal roadmap with the now, next, later roadmap. And so in the now, instead of putting dates in there, just do like the now, and maybe we'll do like a Monte Carlo forecast for like what that now might be, you know, as we get a little bit more detail and by the features. But next and later, like, let's not even put dates on those, because I feel like once you put a date out there, then it's like, yeah, 6 months from now you said you're going to do this thing, and then it's 6 months and new COVID hits and we're working on something completely different, and we're not doing that anymore. You know, like, what are your thoughts on like those further out goal or dates, you know, on your roadmap?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a cool way to approach it. And you know, ultimately, I don't think there's one right way. You know, there's not one right way developer build your roadmap, and there's no roadmap format that will fit any product and every team. However, you know, there are circumstances where it can be useful to put timeframes, more specific timeframes, or even specific dates on the product roadmap. So, you know, if you think about seasonal products like, say, computer games, you know, typically they have to be ready for the Christmas sales in time for the Christmas sales. So this is when a lot of revenue is made. So, you know, then it might make sense to say, okay, you know, a major release and a specific outcome, you know, a specific outcome should be achieved. You know, I don't know. I'm making this up now on the 1st of October. And this is when we'll have a new major release. And then, you know, it'll go on sale from then onwards or shortly after. And, you know, similar thing can be also true for other types of products. I was doing some work in healthcare a number of years ago, and certainly for imaging devices. And there's a trade show in the USA, and I think it's called RSNA. And I believe it's still a very relevant show in order to announce and demo new products, so at least very early versions of a product. And again, so, you know, that being probably a date that you want to have on your roadmap. You know, it's a date you don't necessarily want to miss. But again, you know, just goes to show that, as I said, there is no one right way. And for me, I like to really start with the outcomes. And as I said, you know, I really like to build this kind of narrative, this story, and make sure that there's a meaningful progression from product goal to product goal, from outcome to outcome on the roadmap. And then usually I start thinking about, okay, are there any specific timeframes or dates? And then, you know, there's a discussion around, is it realistic to achieve these goals and create those outcomes within those timeframes? And if not, you know, what's the answer? And in some cases, that means reshaping those goals, those outcomes, and being maybe a little bit less ambitious or more realistic.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, cool. I have very much a love-hate relationship with roadmaps. Like one day I'll wake up and I'll be like, yeah, they're legitimate. We need to know roughly when things are going to get done. And the next day I'll wake up and I'll be like, this is all bullshit. This is all bullshit anyway. We're just guessing when this shit's going to be done anyway. Why am I wasting my time building this out? But I like the way you phrase it, right? Context matters. And two questions. I don't mean the question stack on you, but one, in your experience, like, what have you found is that sweet spot for when a roadmap has practical value to an organization, to a customer, to a stakeholder, just somebody, right? Mm-hmm. You had thrown out maybe 6 to 12 months in that time range. Is that what you found to be a good range to be thinking about a roadmap? Mm-hmm. Actually, let me pause there. What are your thoughts on, you know, the date range that you should be thinking and applying your roadmap to?
Yeah, I like to work with roadmaps sort of in the 6 to 12 month range, even with a slight preference for, you know, the larger range, about 12 months, as long as we're talking about digital products, and as long as we can realistically anticipate, at least roughly, you know, the outcomes we want to create. And, you know, I sort of use the metaphor of a journey, taking our product on a journey or sketching out that journey that we want to take our product on. There's obviously no point if we can't see beyond the next 2 to 3 months to then just create a roadmap that is highly speculative. I think, you know, that's just, for me, that's wasteful. So if you have a choice, don't do it. Mm-hmm. For products that come with hardware, or, you know, contain more than just software, sometimes you need longer roadmaps. You know, sometimes you need to work with 24 month roadmaps, not 24 roadmaps. Sorry, roadmaps that cover 2 years. Yeah, 2 years or maybe even longer, simply because, you know, the cycles, the hardware cycles tend to be longer than the software cycles.
So the other question that I had for you is, you know, we've been talking about outcomes or objectives, and the other side of this is, if you're using something like, let's just say, an OKR, and you've got mm-hmm. just the big audacious goal that you're going after, maybe it's a 12-month goal, maybe it's a 5-year goal, who knows? I've often been of the mindset, like, to me, that's good enough. I have a product backlog that I know I'm going to fill with product goals and smaller objectives that I'm going to be going after. And I know I have clear alignment and visibility to what is our long-term objective that we're going after, regardless of the time frame. Like, leave me alone with the product roadmap. I'm executing, and I'm more concerned with, am I achieving these smaller product goals, mm-hmm. and whether or not, you know, I'm off by a certain amount of time frame, like, who cares, as long as we're making money and we're mm-hmm. being successful with this mm-hmm. stuff. So again, that's kind of like my love hate, but like, what are your thoughts on that? When you're just mm-hmm. have clear alignment on a bigger long-term goal, mm-hmm. where does the roadmap fit into there? Does it fit into there? Is it necessary? What are your thoughts?
Well, I like that you mentioned product goals. And so for me, the goals or outcomes on a roadmap, I mean, for me, they are product goals. And I look at the product roadmap as the link between a higher level product strategy and the product backlog. And so a higher level product strategy would describe who are the users and customers. So who are the beneficiaries of the product, who will use the product, who will pay for the product in one way or another. What is the primary need that the product should address, or what is the main user goal that the product should help the users achieve? You know, what's the specific problem it should address, the specific benefit it should create? What kind of product is it, and what makes the product stand out? So maybe 3 to 5 features that set it apart from alternative offerings, competitor products. And then finally, what's the value that the product creates for the company, for the business developing and providing the product? And so for me, that high level strategy is very useful just to describe how do we create value, and what are our criteria for success, defining that value, so that the user value facing part and the business facing part. But then if that's the approach you take, the essentially the goals that you have in your product strategy, they're hopefully specific, but they're still pretty big. And so I like to take them and break them down into more specific measurable goals. And these are product goals. And these product goals I like to put on the product roadmap. Now, the minimum we need is the next product goal. So, what is the specific and measurable outcome that we'd like to achieve in the next 2 to 3 months with our product? That's the minimum we need. But, often it makes sense to anticipate several more outcomes or product goals. So, 6 to 12 month range, in order to create a continuity of purpose and sketch out that journey that we want to take our product on. And I think that can be very helpful for the stakeholders and for the development teams, just to understand, what might be happening with the product, and mm-hmm. How will it impact my work? That's again true for development teams, and maybe alignment with the technology roadmap, as well as say for marketing and sales, to understand what it'll do to my workload as the sales rep or as the marketeer.
So if you don't have product market fit yet, and you're like a new product, new market, maybe it's an emerging market, you're not exactly sure what your market is or what you're putting out yet. Then when you're doing your roadmap, so you're saying more of that product strategy is really what you're trying to figure out, right? Like you're trying to figure out what those 3 to 5 differentiators are.
Initially,
and what market, and then to go out 6 months or 12 months might be really, might be wasteful even at that point, because you don't know where you're going. We're going to be experimenting and pivoting a lot in the next few months, and we're going to try these things, and then we're going to see where we go from there.
Yeah, that's right. So, there's no point, as I said, speculating, creating a product roadmap if you can't see beyond the next 2 to 3 months. And building on what you just said, I like to suggest that it only makes sense to derive a product roadmap once you have that strategy and once you've shown that the key decisions that you've taken in that strategy, the information that you've captured in that strategy is valid. So it has been validated. So you've carried out some product discovery work and you've done some strategy validation work. So you may have observed users, you may have interviewed users, you may have created some throwaway prototypes and mockups, be it to understand things around desirability or get ideas about how could the user experience design possibly shape out, or think about different technology options. You've maybe looked into the business model and various aspects of the business model just to make sure that the product will be able to generate the desired business benefits, that these are realistic. And I think, that is then a solid basis to consider deriving product goals and asking yourself, can I derive multiple product goals for, say, the next 12 months? Or is all I can see at the moment or describe at the moment a tangible, measurable, specific benefit that we'll need to hit in the next 2 to 3 months? And, you know, again, you know, that's just very much, as you said, it'll depend on, you know, how young is the product and how dynamic is the market, and maybe also how much time and effort did I invest in some upfront product discovery work.
When you're defining out those product goals, I assume that when you're thinking about not just what you're going after, but how much the relative impact is going to be. So let's say retention numbers. We're looking to reduce customer churn from 6% to 4% or whatever that happens to be. Like, I guess, are you explicit with that? Or is it more just we want to reduce customer churn and this is the goal that we're going after?
Yeah, thank you for using a specific example. Now, I'd encourage people to be very specific and state targets on the product roadmap. So again, that's for me the difference between an overarching product strategy, where stating those targets, you know, can feel like you're making things up. It's like, I don't know, you know. So an example I like to use is like a product that helps people improve their eating habits. So, you know, the vision is healthy eating, and then, I don't know, you know, the target market might be middle-aged men like myself, and the benefit might be to reduce the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. And it's like, okay, how much exactly are we going to reduce that risk? It's like, ooh, it's a brand new product. I don't quite know yet. But then, you know, when we let's assume that we still go ahead and say, like, you know, it's a higher level strategic user-related goal, that's going to be okay. But now, in order to actually start building the product, once we've done some, hopefully, some strategy validation and maybe some more product discovery work, we would then need to take that goal and break it down and say, like, okay, now what are the specific tangible user benefits we want to create over the next, whatever it might be? Maybe it's only the next 2 to 3 months, maybe it's the next 12 months. And the same is true with the business benefits, right? And so this is where then you take the business the desired business benefits or business goals stated in your strategy, you take the user goal or goal stated in your strategy, you look at your business model, and that then allows you to derive the right product goals. And so for a brand new product, that might be initially about acquisition, depending on the business model. So if it's more like a freemium product where we give away a basic version for free, I'd probably be interested in initially acquiring a user base, mm-hmm. and maybe helping people understand more about what their actual current eating habits are. And then maybe as a second step, I want to retain users and maybe reduce churn. And again, you know, I have a, and then think about what might be the user benefits that we can provide. And so you obviously don't have to do it that way, but I've sort of developed a preference over the past few years to work with compound product goals on a product roadmap, where I try and capture the business value, the business benefit, and the user benefit. So it's a little bit like a compound user story. You know, there's an end that connects two parts. And it's just helpful to make sure that those two parts are really closely connected. So it is truly a compound goal and not just two goals that sort of, you know, being sold as one.
So can you give an example with your healthy eating app? How will you do the compound goal? Like, what would be an example of that?
Yeah, sure. So it could be help users become more aware of the eating habits and acquire an initial user base. So for me, these two things are closely related. In order to acquire initial users, I have to offer a benefit, and that specific benefit will be an understanding of my eating habits. And then, you know, at the same time, if I do that, then that'll result in that user base, and thereby, you know, the acquisition part will be successfully met. So maybe it's just something to try out and consider and experiment with. I mean, again, you don't necessarily have to do that. I started out with roadmap goals and product goals that were largely focused on the business benefits. But, you know, through numerous conversations and feedback I've received from people, And that was actually suggested to me a few years ago, saying, hey, you know, why do you always work with business focused roadmap goals? And I said, like, well, it kind of feels natural. Mm-hmm. We want to create some value. And it's like, well, the users, well, you know, well, of course, you know, we need to create some user value. Otherwise, we can't realize those business goals. And actually, you know, that's sort of user value is indirectly expressed through the high level features that we put on there. And then sort of, you know, it sort of occurred to me, it would be quite nice to make that user value explicit.
Right. So you have that theme for all those features coming into that. So yeah, I like that, having both those, you know, customer outcome that we're looking for and the business, you know, impact that we're looking to make. So on the same goal. Sometimes it might be hard though. Like I was just thinking, like in your example, like how do I quantify, like, am I the user goal there? Like what would I do? But I guess that's a whole nother product conversation. We have to know more about our app.
It's just very briefly. I mean, you're absolutely right. And this is where the value of some product discovery work and some strategizing work comes in. If you know, you've got a high level strategy, but you really struggle to now derive specific and measurable product goals, then that may indicate that actually you haven't done quite enough product discovery and you don't really understand the market enough, and you don't really quite understand enough what is really needed now in order to create value. And so, you know, it might be a good idea to consider going back and doing a little bit more product discovery work. So I don't want to advertise big upfront product discovery, not at all. But there's a trade-off and there's a balance between rushing to build something and get a product out, and then the danger of, well, building the wrong thing.
Yep. Yeah, I don't know where I heard this analogy, but I like it. It's like if you're, you know, two ships and you're fighting a war, first you fire bullets and you fire cannonballs, right? So like that's your product discovery. We're shooting bullets and like, oh, I missed off by 30 yards. Like readjust and then shoot again. Yep, okay, we hit it. Now let's shoot a cannonball, you know? Usually it's going to take many more tries than that. But that's a good analogy there. And you can do it with a much smaller team, that product discovery, which I think is a lot of times what... You know, we get into organizations and it's like, let's go. We need five teams work on this product. And you're like, whoa, we haven't even like validated anything yet. Let's just start with a very, very small team and validate some things before we spend a bunch of money. So yeah, I think that's a common pattern of not doing enough discovery sometimes, or maybe doing too much. How do you find that right balance? Like what's your rule of thumb? Like how do you find the right balance for product discovery and then going too far, you know, on the analysis side or not enough?
So I really like the build, measure, learn model that Eric Ries suggested quite a few years ago now. I like to apply it to the product strategy. So for me, you know, when I think about product discovery work, I'm always kind of drawn towards the strategy. I guess I've got a strategy bias. So to put it differently, product strategy, creating an initial product strategy and validating that strategy, showing that the strategy is likely to result in a successful product, for me is part and parcel of some product discovery work. So the two things go together, or you know, I guess product discovery is a superset of the strategy work. That's maybe another way to look at it, if I'm making sense.
Talk about this quite a bit, where it's build, measure, learn, but you have to start with the learn part, right? Like what is it you want to learn, and then how are you going to measure that learning, and then you go and actually you start building it. And I think that's right in line with what you're talking about from the strategizing side. Like you have to know what the destination is before you start on your journey.
So you know, I've always thought, the way I understand the build, measure, learn model, that you basically formulate a testable assumption and hypotheses based on what you know right now, and then you test it out. And it may be true, it may be wrong. So sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes you need to do a little bit of upfront, literally upfront research, upfront discoveries, just so that you can formulate, you know, an initial product strategy that is good enough so that it's testable, so that you can see where are the assumptions. And, you know, as I've got a long Agile background, and, you know, in Agile, we've talked about risks, it seems forever, at least as long as I can remember, I like to suggest identifying risks rather than testable assumptions, hypotheses. What are the key risks and what is the biggest risk, the most urgent risk, or the risk that must be addressed most urgently at this point in time to avoid that we're making wrong decisions and going down the wrong path. And then you iterate over your product strategy and address risk after risk until you've sufficiently de-risked it. So the strategy has been validated. That's at least my take on it. Once there are no significant risks left. I mean, by significant, I mean really risks that could severely, severely reduce the likelihood of creating value and, you know, achieving product success eventually. You know, so, you know, things like we're confident that we've chosen the right target market with the right users and the right customers. So it's the right market segment. We're chosen that we've got a compelling value proposition that we've selected the right needs, and that, you know, the three standout features that we've, the differentiators that we've chosen for our product, they're solid. And, you know, our one or two or three business goals, they're realistic, and we've got a business model in order to create the desired business value. So, you know, it all makes sense, and we've got data to show it. You know, we've carried out those user interviews, we've done the observation, you know, we've done this, we've done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that the thing people got to think about is those assumptions or risks that we might have might not just be product related or for the business model related. They might be technically related. They can be either side of the equation. And so whatever that biggest risk is, how do you validate that? And how do you validate it as cheaply as possible without building the whole thing? I always go back to the Zappos example, right? Like, why would we build out all the infrastructure of how to deliver shoes across the world if we don't even think people will buy, or if we're not sure if people will buy shoes online? Like, they might want to try them on. If they've never done that before and bought them online, will they really do that? Like, and they found, well, yeah, they will buy them online, but only when they can return them, right? Like, if there's a high friction cost for returning, then people are like, no, I'll go to the store and try them on because I want to make sure they fit well. And so, like, they had to discover that part first before they went and built all, you know, millions of dollars of infrastructure to make that work, you know? So, yeah, I think that's a good use case for, you know, first thing might not be to build technology. It might be to validate something else, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I thank you for sharing that, Jeff. And I think, you know, what it shows is that a product discovery and particularly strategy creation or strategy work in general and strategy validation is best carried out by a cross-functional team. So if it's just the person in charge of the product, if it's just the product owner who does it, then, you know, that's great. But it's great that somebody does it, right? And it's good to have the product owner actively involved there and lead the effort. I think that's really important. So, you know, I always feel sorry for those product owners who've been basically get a brief or get a strategy or even get a roadmap and then being told, now go and execute. So I think it's really important that the product owner plays an active role in product discovery and the strategizing work and actually leads it. However, I think it's equally important, and, you know, I think your example just really nicely illustrates that, you know, key stakeholders, for a commercial product, that might be somebody from marketing, sales, support, maybe finance, that those individuals are involved as well, and representatives from the development team or the development team. So typically somebody with UX skills, if it's an end user facing product, somebody with architecture and programming knowledge, and maybe somebody who knows about how the product can be tested. So you have a holistic outlook on, you know, hidden assumptions and risks and issues. And you can then leverage the collective expertise of that group. And as the product owner, you're not kind of on your own, and it's not your sole responsibility to get everything right and see all those risks. So yeah, I'm a big fan of a collaborative discovery and a collaborative strategizing approach.
So you just brought up at least in my experience, a pretty common scenario where you're working with a product owner who's really more of an order taker or a backlog manager, very much down at the tactical level of execution, not getting a lot of visibility or encouragement to operate more at the strategic level. What advice, what feedback do you give to someone who is in that type of position? Like, what's that first step for that you recommend to try to break out of that cycle?
So I think, you know, it's always good to, you know, just in a way be honest towards ourselves and say, you know, that's my current role. And I think, you know, that's really where we have to start. And then, you know, if I'm a product owner and I'm largely focused on working on the product backlog, then I think it'd be good to understand, okay, who are the people who decide on the product goals and the product roadmap and the product strategy? And can I work with those individuals? Can I be involved in setting those product goals? And can I be involved in the roadmapping work? And can I maybe be even involved in the strategy work or the discovery work, at least to a certain extent? And I think there's a twofold benefit. One is to fully understand those decisions, so you can then I can then implement them, on the tactical level and execute them essentially. And there's a strong alignment between the product backlog and the roadmap, but also then to be able to influence and make suggestions and maybe raise some concerns and say like, okay, but how practically speaking, how would we actually do this? I mean, it's not uncommon to have a split where you have a more strategic product person and a more a tactical or sometimes, you know, also referred to a technical, a product manager, product owner. But and that can work, and it's a common scaling pattern. It's a common scaling approach. But I find it works best when a product is stable. I don't think, in my experience, it works particularly well when you work on a brand new product or a product that's changing significantly.
Yeah. And when is a product really stable? Like, I mean, there's always change happening in the complex adaptive world that we live in today, right? I mean, I don't know if you agree. Like, what product would you say is stable where you'd be like, yeah, we can scale all product owners and just do features without actually validating in the marketplace? Is there an environment you can think of?
Well, you know, I'm sitting here in front of an iMac and I'm looking around. So, you know, Mac OS, the operating system's been around for quite a while, and it seems a fairly stable, fairly mature product. To me, it's also a fairly big product by the looks of it. So, you know, using the product lifecycle model can be really useful to track the value that your product creates over time. And then when you see the value flattening off and you decide not to extend the product lifecycle and change the product, update it more significantly, possibly by taking it to a new market or adding some brand new features or brand new technologies, but you move into maturity, then you typically have a lot of stability and you typically tend to focus on incremental enhancements and bug fixes. And so, you know, that's then a stage, or that's then an environment where splitting the product ownership as I indicated, having a more strategic and a more tactical role might make sense. Something I'd be probably be careful with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Every time I've seen that implement, I mean, I've seen extreme cases where I'll tell you, there's one story where I walked into a product area where it was one-to-one relationship, people working on product and people actually doing the work and developing the product. So like, tell me how that could work or how efficient that is, effective that is. What ended up happening was there's just a lot of lists all over the place and everybody's very specialized and focused on their own individual thing and no one was thinking about the big picture. And the person who's trying to think about the big picture just didn't have enough visibility because there's just so many layers to try to get their arms around it. So I guess I think that there's trade-offs in everything that you do. And so if you're going to go that route where you have more of that tactical product owner, then you're going to have more coordination and dependencies inside of your product. And that's going to slow down delivery. And so you just have to be okay with that, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I fully agree. And, you know, we can take this a step further and say is a tactical product owner a Scrum product owner? I mean, the idea of the product owner is, at least in Scrum, that somebody who plays the role is responsible. I think the latest Scrum guide even suggests accountable for the value that the product creates and for maximizing that value. Now, how can I truly maximize the value of my product if I'm only empowered to make tactical execution-oriented decisions? So essentially, if I only have ownership of the product backlog. So I really think to be an effective Scrum product owner, people require what I call full stack ownership, ownership of the strategic level and the tactical level. And that tends to be also beneficial in order to make sure that strategic and tactical decisions, the strategy and the execution part, are really closely aligned, so there are no inconsistencies. And it'd be a shame if we spend a lot of time, you know, with discovery and strategizing work, you know, and then kind of hand that off and other people do the execution and maybe misinterpret or misunderstand some of the decisions that we've taken, you know, and then you get that misalignment, and that's going to hurt. That's going to hurt the product success. And I don't think it's a nice environment to be in. Mm-hmm. But yeah, unfortunately, I don't think that's always fully understood.
Yeah. So if you were a tactical product owner and you wanted to be a Scrum product owner and you wanted to have, you know, be full stack product owner, like we're just talking about, what would be your first step? Like, what would be the, I know you said like go to the meetings, but anything else that you would yeah. do? Like,
yeah, nice question. Yes. The other thing I would suggest is to try and educate yourself a little bit about product roadmapping practices and product strategy and product discovery. And again, you know, that puts you then in a good position to be able to make suggestions and influence. And it also shows that you care and that there's some expertise. I remember having a conversation a little while back with a product owner, and she, and then it was sort of a little bit, you know, in the context that we're just discussing. And she said to me, "Oh, Roman, you know, my management doesn't allow me to take charge of the product roadmap." So we got talking, and, you know, it turned out that, and so now we got talking. I was sort of starting to tell the story the wrong way. Oh, man. After a little while, I said to her, "Have you created a product roadmap before? You kind of confident that you know how to do it?" And she said, looked at me slightly surprised and said, like, "No." And so, you know, my answer then to her was that while, you know, I think it would be nice for her management to show support and empower her and encourage her, you know, it's kind of hard to trust somebody do a good job if you're not sure that the person can do it. And again, you know, I know that, you know, management should help people and, you know, encourage people to carry out the right learning and development measures and so forth. But, you know, I actually said to her, for you, maybe a good step would be that you try out some roadmapping techniques, that you create a roadmap for your product and show it to your management. And that way you kind of prove that, you know, you're interested, you're capable, and maybe that's all that's needed so that, you know, you're then actually, you know, formally authorized to do it. But I don't think that was necessarily the answer she wanted to hear. I think she wanted me to tell her that her management would have to change. But, you know, as always, it's, you know, the only person we can truly change is ourselves, right? And we can only encourage others and influence others and hope for the best. So,
yeah, I think that taking that ownership and then like doing it with somebody and be like, "Well, what if we did it this way?" And like kind of leading through that, I don't know. Somebody was asking me for career advice recently, and I'm just like, and I had to tell them, like, more often than not, if you want something, like you want to do this job or this, you know, this role or whatever, you have to just do it, and then you'll get the position later. So like, just start doing it, I think, is a big thing. But then think about the after effects of that, I think, is another thing that sometimes product owners miss. And what if, do you need to now hire a new tactical product owner if you're going to move up into the strategic product owner? Or what if you could enable your team to do some of that stuff? So how could you teach your team to take on maybe some more of the tactical things that you're doing on the Scrum team so that you can maybe just have one product owner into the future? So you're kind of in a good position where you can give some things away and take on some new items and maybe, you know, get more focus for the team because you only have one product owner, one vision, one strategy, you know, and you can get to that point as a team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were just talking about career development, Jeff, and it reminded me of when I was first starting to. So I had raised my hand. I said, I want to be a manager. I want to start going this route, people manager. And exactly, Roman, what you were just talking about was like, you know, great, that's an intent, but where's the skill set? Where's the experience level to help me going down there? And so I had awesome leadership, and they're like, "Okay, well, let's come up with a plan of what that looks like." And part of that development was me actually, we started a high school internship program that I built up, and it was I think 3 months that we would bring in just one high school student, but I would manage them, and that was a very safe environment for me to fail in, to start getting management experience. And so trying to tie this into what we've just been talking about is, okay, well, you're not included in building the roadmaps. Okay, well, then just go fucking make one yourself, right? And like see how that turns out, right? In a safe environment, right? And as you start to show the experience, well, great, maybe that allows you to actually step in and start doing more of those things. So I think what we're saying is initiative is one thing, but you have to literally gain the skill set in order to show experience in there to get trust. And man, we were just talking about trust building before. But I think that's part of this conversation as well. It's just showing that you're trustworthy in execution for the skills that you're trying to take on.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, one of the key challenges for product people is that, you know, product people in general and, you know, product owners, Scrum product owners lack transactional power, right? We're not line managers. We're not the boss. We can't tell the development teams and the stakeholders what to do, at least usually. And, you know, to make things worse, we can't offer specific, we can't offer any incentives like a bonus or pay rise usually. And so, you know, we really have to rely on our ability to influence the stakeholders and development teams in order to align them, to guide them, to lead them. And trust is a massive factor in that. You know, people are not gonna follow our lead if they don't trust us. And I think expertise is one of the trust building factors. I mean, I'm not gonna, you know, if here in the UK, you know, I think the biggest mountain is Snowdon or one of the biggest mountains. Or no, it's not in the UK. That's not true. Well, it doesn't matter. I'm kidding. I'm not good with my stories today. It's Friday afternoon here in the UK. But you know, I mean, it's like think about it. You intend to walk up a mountain, and there's a mountain guide, and you ask the individual, well, you know your stuff. And it's like, well, I'm pretty new at this. But surely you've walked up this mountain many times before. Well, actually, no, it's my first time. I mean, would you feel confident then following the person's lead? I probably wouldn't. So, I think, you know, showing expertise builds trust, just like caring for people, being empathic and taking a real interest and listening to people. I think, you know, that shows that you can value people's perspective and ideas and concerns. And acting with integrity, you know, saying what is true and not bullshitting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, trust is one of those funny things. Like you can trust somebody in a certain context, but not in another context. So I guess I wouldn't want product owners to go out and think, oh, my organization doesn't trust me. I should go find a new organization. It's like they probably trust you maybe with the tactical stuff, like we're that tactical product owner. They don't trust you with strategic stuff yet. So work with somebody to go up that mountain on the strategy side. So that you've been through this road once or twice before. So then they'll say, okay, now you're ready to lead that part of it because they'll have trust because you've gone up that mountain already with a guide, you know, experienced guide. And so I, you know, push for those experiences and then be the guide for somebody else too. You know, like I think that's always, you know, maybe that message from before is like, don't just be the one taking everything. Also have to give back to others around you. Would be my advice.
So Roman, you were just talking about these values of product ownership, being empathetic, being trustworthy. We've got our Scrum values, right? Courage, commitment, openness, focus, and respect. But are there other kind of values that you think are important for product owners, or that you kind of help coach or nudge product owners to encourage them to live or display these types of values, if you will?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I don't really think so much of values. Maybe it's just a wording. I think more of kind of key skills. And when I look back at, so I've been involved in product management, both product management and Agile for about 20 years now. And I think product management's changed significantly. And I personally would say for the better. But a lot of the work that's been done in product management over the past 10, 15, 20 years is very much focused on the hard skills. You know, we talked about product roadmaps and we talked about product goals. We talked a little bit about product strategy and product discovery and strategy validation. We could go on and talk about the product backlog. And I mean, these are all super important skills for product people, for product owners. But you know, if we don't develop our soft skills, our people skills, or what I would call our leadership skills as Scrum product owners, then we'll never be able to effectively apply our product roadmapping skills. You know, we'll always struggle to secure the necessary buy-in from the stakeholders and development teams. People might not trust us. People might not be willing to listen to us and follow our lead, follow our suggestions. So things around empathy, I think, is a really big one and kind of comes natural anyway to most product people because, you know, if we don't develop empathy, if we don't cultivate empathy, then we have a hard time usually to engage with users and customers and do any form of user research. Mm-hmm. And if that's what we're struggling, then it'll be difficult for us to develop a thorough understanding of the user and customer needs and then make the right product decisions. And so it's just kind of bringing, you know, skills that we anyway have, bringing them to the stakeholders and the development team members. You know, and sometimes that's easy. Sometimes it's easy to empathize with stakeholders if we like the individuals or if we agree with their views. But if we disagree with their views and we find them not particularly likable, then, you know, it's a little bit harder. But empathy doesn't mean that, you know, we think the person's great. It just means that we show a real genuine respectful interest in the person's perspectives and needs and any feelings that might be present, and that we reach out with warmheartedness and we care, you know, we genuinely care for the people we work with, for the stakeholders and development team members. So yeah, that's a big deal for me. And then, you know, I think we've mentioned things like active listening. Again, I think that's a great technique for product owners. Things around collaborative decision-making, involving stakeholders and development team members in making complex and high impact decisions, important decisions, I think is another important one. Dealing with disagreement and conflict. So, you know, we have cross-functional development teams. Stakeholders typically come from different parts of the organization. So, you know, that just means that people will have different perspectives and they may have different needs and interests. And so, you know, it's the natural that friction is present, and dealing with friction, dealing with conflict in a constructive way so that, you know, conflict isn't just ignored. Or, you know, one person wins and the other person loses. And so, you know, but in a way where there are no bad feelings left. And, you know, people maybe even can work better together and have a better connection, a better relationship through, you know, effective conflict resolution. So again, you know, for me, these are super important skills.
I would add humility. Because product, anytime you're building product, I feel like there's, you know, it has a way of humbling you. When you think you're right, when you think you got it all figured out, you'll learn something that, you know, totally, you know, turns your world upside down. And that's normal. And so, yeah, having that humility and then being able to lifelong learners, being like, yep, okay, that didn't work. What could work? What do we learn from that? And taking that in stride and not taking it personally, like, oh, I lost something there because this didn't work. And it's like, no, we learned something that didn't work. Let's just, what can we learn about this? How could we use that for an advantage and a positive in the future? Like, what could we do wrong next? I think those are also two really important things for product people.
Yeah. I fully agree. One of the worst things, you know, we can make as product people is to cling to our ideas, to cling to preconceived notions and ideas and think, you know, it must be that way, which is kind of natural. The longer you look after a product, the more attached you become. And so mm-hmm. it's then developing some awareness around that. And as you said, Jeff, you know, understanding that failure is part of an innovation process and our ideas don't always work out, and cultivate that humbleness, but also maybe that receptivity and open-mindedness and saying, like, you know, yeah, I mean, it sounds corny, but seeing failure as an opportunity rather than a disaster. But again, you know, that's down partly, I think, to mindset and attitude. It's a personal choice, but it's also a cultural aspect. So some organizations I've worked with and for were better at encouraging failure and tolerating mistakes, and others weren't that great. Mm-hmm. It's just that makes it a little bit harder, right, to sort of, you know, have that attitude where you say, like, well, you know, we'll do our best, and, you know, but, you know, it's risky creating new products and creating new features. There's always a risk, no matter how much validation we do, no matter how much discovery we do. And things might not work out perfectly, or I might be wrong. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've mentioned this a few times now, but I'm kind of a fanboy for the CEO of the organization I'm with right now. And one of the first things that he had said, it was just a fly on the wall for a meeting, but it was something kind of bad happened. And he said, we either succeed or we learn. What did we learn here? And I thought that was really telling, where it wasn't, you know, we weren't afraid necessarily of failure. Sure, we all want to succeed, but when we fail, we need to make sure that we're learning something in that experience. And I just heard that resonate in what you were saying. One of the other things, well, actually two things that you had mentioned here earlier, Roman. One was conflict, and not being afraid of conflict, but being respectful in the conflict. I would say part of that is the ability to say no. Right. Like as a product owner, I really feel like that's one of the most important, I don't even want to say skills, but like characteristics. A product owner needs to have the authority, the accountability, however you want to phrase that, to say no. Right. Like if I'm ordering something on my backlog and just because a stakeholder comes in says they want it, a product owner needs to have that ability to say no, or at least not now. Right. And you mentioned it earlier, right? If I'm accountable for maximizing value as a product owner, but I'm not allowed to say no to anything, I'm really probably just not interested in that role at all. But then the other thing that you were talking about with all those characteristics, skills, attributes, however we want to think about them, I always think of when I teach the product owner course, the end of day one is we wrap the day up talking about values. We talk about the Scrum values. And I always phrase it the same way. Like, you got to be a good person, right? Scrum has values. And I just kind of summarize them. You can't be a jerk, right? You've got to be a good person. You've got to care. You've got to display all of these. And that's what makes it professional. And that's what I was hearing in a lot of things that you were talking about is, nobody wants to work with the jerk, right? Nobody wants to follow the jerk. So don't be a jerk, and you're probably going to be a good product leader for your team, for your organization.
It's kind of hard to win people's trust if you behave in unethical ways. That's just the way it is. So I think it's important to be ethical, do what is right, and act with integrity.
All right, Roman, at this time, is there anything you wanted to plug or promote? I mean, besides your books and your podcasts and other things that you have going on, is there anything else you'd like to promote to our listeners?
Ooh, well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. So if you're more interested, anybody who's more interested in my thoughts and ideas, just maybe check out my website, romanpischler.com. And so, yeah, I've already kindly mentioned it. I've written a few books, and there's quite a few articles available, little templates that you can download from my website. Mm-hmm. You can listen to some of my articles. I've also made an effort to try and record more YouTube videos, which has sort of stalled because I've sort of struggled to find enough time to fit it into my schedule. And then I teach as well and offer consulting services. So, yeah, maybe just have a look around my website.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming. We really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it as well. It's really nice to talk to you too.
Thank you for listening to The Agile Wire. We are consistently inspecting and adapting ourselves. We would appreciate feedback at feedback@theagilewire.com or on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play Store. See you next time.